Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Sinead Mooney. With voting in the US presidential race already well underway, the tail end of the week on air was characterised by lots of interviews with commentators, pundits and partisan supporters. On Thursday's Drive Time, Sarah McInerney spoke to a woman who fell into the latter category, Jennifer Ewing, spokesperson for Republicans Overseas UK. When Sarah put it to Jennifer that it seems surprising that Donald Trump seems to be getting quite a lot of support from Latino voters, particularly because of comments he's made about immigrants having blood that isn't the same as American people, Jennifer had a very different interpretation of those comments.
When he refers to the blood, what he was talking about is the fentanyl poisoning that's going on due to, you know, the illegal crime and the poisoning of the blood that way. So, yeah.
So when he said they're poisoning the blood of our country, you say he means what?
Okay, you know how we have a fentanyl crisis in the United States? Fentanyl, it's a drug that even
in very small doses. Yeah.
Okay, so that's what he was talking to. If you listen to when he speaks of poisoning the blood, he is referring to the fentanyl crisis due to the Venezuelan and other such gangs that have come illegally into the United States. So that has been wildly taken out of context.
That sounds like a mad explanation to me, Jennifer. I read you one of the quotes, and he said it a couple of times, but this is one of the quotes. Illegal immigration is poisoning the blood of our nation. They're coming from prisons, from mental institutions, from all over the world. And you're saying he's referring to a fentanyl crisis?
Yeah, that's 100% what I'm talking about. And he also said illegal immigration.
What's the difference? Illegal immigration or immigration? They're all still people.
No, Sarah, they're not. We have had, and even Kamala Harris is now running on saying, you know, she will now all of a sudden close the southern border to illegal people. We have a problem. We've got
I understand that. I understand there's a problem with illegal immigration. But to say that illegal immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country suggests that illegal immigrants have a poison in their blood that other people don't have.
No, it's not. That's not at all what that suggests.
And that conversation continued along similar lines for another couple of minutes before Sarah moved on and brought up the subject of Donald Trump's assertion that if elected, he's going to put Robert Kennedy Jr. in charge of healthcare.
He's talking about Robert F. Kennedy here. He said, going to let him go wild on the food. I'm going to let him go wild on the medicines. Now, Robert F. Kennedy is the person who has compared vaccine requirements with the Nazi Germany era, and he's pushed wild conspiracy theories about chemicals in the water making children gay or transgender. Do you think he's the right person to be put in charge of healthcare in the United States?
I think Bobby Kennedy Jr. Joining the Trump campaign is one of the best things to happen to the campaign all election season. I mean, not only is he Democratic royalty, but what he cares about, and you'll notice this is going to bring a lot of women on board, a lot of mothers on board. We do have a problem in the United States with our food being full of poison. It's fantastic that Bobby is talking about this along with the woman who I hope runs for governor of California one day in my home state, called Nicole Shanahan.
Along with chemicals in the water making children gay or transgender.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I mean, we do know that the chemicals in some of the water are causing a lot of little girls to start developing
I'm not suggesting that's true. I'm saying it's a wild conspiracy theory that the person who may be put in charge of healthcare in the United States thinks is true.
From Thursday's Drive Time and staying with the U.S. election.
It is as close as it can be in the seven battleground states that are going to decide the election. This is my 10th presidential election, and this is the most complicated.
CNN's chief national correspondent John King has become something of a go-to on election night and in the days following the election, when we're all trying to make sense of how America voted. He spoke to Áine Lawler on Friday's Morning Ireland, and one of the questions Áine asked him was, will Donald Trump accept a loss?
No, he and his people are already, and this is sad, and it's anti-democratic, but he and his people are already planting the seeds of distrust and mistrust, and they're putting out a lot of disinformation, even about the early voting process, saying that there are irregularities when there are no major irregularities as we approach election day. This is a playbook Donald Trump has used before. We expect him to come out on election night and say he won the election, And we know that late on election night, we're not going to know yet. It could be several days again, just like it was in 2020. So that part is sad. But we know the playbook and just believe what he says. He's been saying this as he campaigns across the country, that he's already questioning the process.
So election night, and indeed not just election night, but probably the days and nights to come, will you be back at the Magic Wall?
I will be on a very short leash within a foot or two of my friend, as I call the Magic Wall. I think it's the most powerful information tool in journalism. And we've been at it for 16 years now, and we constantly make it better, but also keep its basics that I hope the American people and people around the world trust, especially in this age where, unfortunately, people are constantly attacking the process, attacking the integrity of our vote count, attacking the integrity of the news media. I think it's important to have things that people trust and people feel comfortable with. And so I take a lot of pride that the Magic Wall has become sort of an iconic piece of election coverage, not just here in the States, but around the world.
And you have you've a new app, don't you, for all the political nerds out there. We can all delve down into Maricopa County as you brought us through in 2020 for ourselves.
And I hope the people of Ireland will do that. Join with me, right? Unfortunately, we have to have the Ireland version so I can show you where I'm from in Connemara. Right, go up into
it
Galway.
It all begins in Dunlochan, isn't that right?
Yeah, that is correct. And so if I could zoom in on, County Galway and then take us out to Dunlochan, that would be great. We'll have to do the Ireland edition of the Magic Wall as soon as we can.
From Friday's Morning Ireland, later in the news at 1, we heard excerpts from the candidates' rallies in Nevada the previous night.
Hillary was a liar, a horrible scoundrel, but this one lies so much, and she's a low IQ individual. She doesn't even know she's lying, I'm telling you. This is not what you want for your president. That has nothing to do with me. This is not what you want. She's a very low IQ individual. She's dumb as a rock, and you can't have that.
He is not someone who is thinking about how to make your life better. And this is someone who is increasingly unstable, obsessed with revenge, consumed with grievance, and he's out for unchecked power. And in less than 90 days, either he or I will be sitting in the Oval Office.
One of the most notable features of this election was how divisive it became, not just along the usual party lines, but between men and women. When David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian, spoke to Rachel English on Friday's News at 1, Rachel asked him if the gender gap could really be a deciding factor in the election.
I think it could. I've been covering this for nearly a decade now, the 2016 and 2020 elections, and we've always had a lot of debates then about the importance of class and of race. But it does appear this time it might be gender that is the deciding factor. There's a historic gender gap, or one might call it a gender gulf, with Donald Trump enjoying a healthy lead among men and Kamala Harris even further ahead among women. And you see this manifested in the fact that it's a man versus a woman, and that at Trump's rally yesterday, we had lots of machismo. We had the song, "It's a Man's, Man's, Man's World." We have various celebrities backing him, ripping off their shirts and giving a certain old-fashioned masculinity, whereas Kamala Harris enjoys much more support among women. She criticizes Trump's misogyny, and of course she's really going big on the whole issue of abortion. And so far, among early voting, women have voted, they're about 10 points ahead of men. So that's a good sign for the Harris campaign. Obviously, we might see more men come through on election day itself. This gender gulf really could be decisive this time.
From Friday's News at 1, there was widespread condemnation of the Israeli parliament for its vote this week to ban the UN Palestinian agency UNRWA from Gaza and other territories. As Israeli airstrikes and the death toll in Gaza continued to mount this week, Dr. Raja Musla, Med Global's country director, who has recently returned to the US from Gaza, spoke to Cormac O'Hara on Tuesday's Drive Time. Here she describes treating a 10-year-old girl whose family had all just been killed, who had 90% burns to her body.
Unfortunately, as a doctor or healthcare provider, I cannot reduce her pain because we don't have sedation inside the Shifa hospital in this moment.
And was she in pain? I think you said she was a 10-year-old who's...
Yes, yeah. Until the moment I am traumatized and I am thinking about this girl until now because I cannot reduce her pain. And unfortunately, the whole family member has been killed because they are bombing her home. And I cannot tell her that her family is passed away. She asked about her mom and her father, her sisters and brothers, and I cannot tell her that the whole family has been dead. Until 4 a.m. early morning, I was hold her hand, and I feel her skin burn at my hand until the moment. And her voice is stuck in my head until the moment, and she is suffering from pain, and I cannot reduce her pain as a healthcare provider. She passed away at 4 a.m. early morning. She's suffering from pain, and I cannot reduce her pain. And thank God she passed away, and she maybe find peace in another place.
Yeah.
It's better than the world we are living in. And I feel guilty until the moment she asked me to lie beside her in the bed, and I cannot do that because I am a human being, and simply I cannot stay beside her in the bed until the moment I feel guilty and I'm not good, because all the time I'm asking myself why I did not stay beside her in the bed.
From Tuesday's Drive Time, the devastation caused by flash flooding in Spain was another story which received a lot of coverage on air this week. On Friday, Claire Byrne spoke to Jonathan Swain, senior news correspondent with ITV's Good Morning Britain. He described the region as being like a war zone.
Yeah, it's exactly how it feels. I've been to many war zones, sadly, and I can't believe that this is Valencia, a major city where tourists go on holiday, and yet some of the scenes that we're witnessing, people, not only the devastation that's happened there and what you've just been describing, the cars upturns, the deaths now of almost 160, of course that's going to rise, but people are now fleeing the region, you know, walking with just the clothes on their backs and maybe a small bag, and they're walking to try and find a hotel or staying with friends in nearby cities and towns. There's an exodus last night as the sun was, you know, falling over Spain or Valencia, and it was quite a harrowing and eerie sight to see, and thinking they're not getting the help that they want. I know you've been talking in the news this morning about the government, the Irish government, offering support to the Spanish, and they're promising, I think, 250 million euros in terms of Spain are to help the relief effort, but that is certainly not on the ground that we have witnessed on the last 2 days. I mean, I've been talking to residents, you know, families there who are, you know, asking us for a bottle of water that we've been carrying, you know, from a local supermarket, handing out just a little bits of Coke and snacks that we have. I mean, this is really hand-to-mouth stuff for these people, and you can't believe that we're witnessing this.
So you're not seeing the help arriving there, and people are taking the decision just to leave?
They're taking the decision to leave because they're in a home, but some of them have their water cut off, some of them have their power cut off. Even their pets are scared. We saw them walking through the heavy mud this morning, and the dogs were physically shaking, and you know, they're traumatized by what's happened. Imagine what it's like for small children and for families as well. So there's a lot of anger because the soldiers, as you were talking about there in the army, yes, these figures of 1,000 soldiers are being talked about, but they're certainly not on the ground where they are needed, and people there are incredibly angry, and they feel very, very abandoned by their Spanish government and by the authorities. There's been some really remarkable personal stories of neighbors, you know, wading through neck-deep water to go into the neighbour's apartment to rescue them, to pull them out, and then to take them up to high levels of their apartment blocks. People, I've spoken to a guy called Alex who was just fleeing that area yesterday and walking into Valencia. We saw him on the side of the motorway. He described for a while he was in his car neck-deep in water, and he managed to get himself out of that.
From Today with Claire Byrne on Friday. For the second year running, Anne-Marie McLean from Letterkenny was the leading Irish woman to cross the line in this year's Dublin City Marathon. After the race, she spoke to Greg Allen about just how much the win means to her.
You know what? I wear my heart on my sleeve, and you guys interviewed me 2 weeks ago at the launch, and you knew how emotional I was. I wanted that today. I'm ready. I'm 45 in February. I'm ready to take a little step to the side and let all them young ones come true. But today I wanted that, because doing it once is good, but doing it twice is hard. And they don't come around that often. And I had company there till halfway, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I was like, I'm going to have to stay and not panic. And I didn't panic. And I was holding back tears at 24 mile, because I was like, my hamstrings were pinging a bit. And I had a wee mantra on my hand, and I kept saying it. My sister's home from London, and the last time she seen me race was in 1995 in Dungarvan, County Waterford, at the Schools International. And in my heart, I wanted to do it for her. She's seen me running in Europe, but not in Ireland since 1995, so that one was for her.
Amory, just a quick potted history of your career. Brilliant junior, then you decided to leave the sport at 23, came back at 32, and now you're back at 44, defending your Dublin Marathon title. You might go again next year for three in a row, but it's incredible.
I'm tired mentally. Not physically, mentally. You know, I give everything 100%, and people don't see what we do when behind the scenes, you know, and my Trevor and my kids and what we put to the side for 12 weeks. I'm ready to enjoy this one more than I did last one.
Anne-Marie McGlynn, as heard on Monday's Morning Ireland Sports Bulletin. Staying on the mean streets of Dublin, David McRedmond, on PUS CEO and chair of the Dublin City Centre Task Force, came into Drive Time on Tuesday to talk about the task force's recently published plan.
So it's not about a plan about the most exciting ideas. There's many people out there who come up with more interesting and different ideas. It's about what could really work. And over a period of 3 to 5 years, if we did these things, will we get Dublin One to be, as we've said, one of the most vibrant,
most exciting neighbourhoods?
I think so.
Really?
I absolutely think so.
Because
we've
heard about that area, maybe unfairly, is people's fears about their safety for going into it.
And you have to address all of the things. And that's what's essential about this report, is you can't just pick one or two elements. But, you know, places like Kreuzberg in Berlin or Hackney in London or different neighbourhoods, and quite often it's neighbourhoods that have been deprived, that turn around best. Why?
Okay.
Because there's a lot of derelict property.
So give me some of the ideas that would transform this O'Connell Street area into a great area again.
Sure. I think one would be to take the major derelict sites for the council to acquire them, turn them into high density residential, and probably be private sector paying for that, and give at least a quarter of them over to essential workers in the city, guards, nurses, teachers, street cleaners. And that brings into O'Connell Street, into the heart of our city, people who are about the future of the city and people who are living there. And Dublin, let's remember this. Dublin is one of the literary capitals of the world. Dublin is a major international city. It's not quite a global city like London or New York, but it's a major international city. That's such an attractive place.
But that sounds like mom and apple pie. But if you were to come on the airways, David, and say that after the Dublin riots some months ago, people would have reacted maybe differently.
Yeah, and cities have problems. Cities are sketchy places. Paris has riots. London has riots. New York has riots. Cities are sketchy places, but you've got to believe them, push them, and if we do it as Dubliners together, I think we can transform.
Okay.
From Tuesday's Drive Time. Being the week that was in it, there were plenty of items about fairies and leprechauns on air this week. Sheena Quinn and Dermot Flynn have written and illustrated a new book called The Fairy Isle, which, as the title suggests, is all about fairies. As Dermot tells Oliver here, his interest in fairies goes back to his childhood.
My mum and father are from Kilkenny and Leitrim, respectively. So around where my mum is from in Kilkenny, I found a map. There's all these fairy forts around North Kilkenny.
Yeah.
And then where my dad is from, I went around. He grew up on the side of Loch Allen overlooking Slieve an Éireann, which is where the fairies apparently first arrived in Ireland.
Well, that's interesting. And they claim the fairies first, they decided Leitrim was the place to land.
Well, it's long time fair, yeah. My dad, he worked in the mines in Erigna, and apparently there's stories about the fairies diverting mountain streams into neighbouring mines to destroy them and all this. So there's a lot, and there's like There's mermaids in Loch Gill, there's mermaids in Loch Allen, all this. So there's a lot of stuff going on up there.
God, yeah. There is a lot. And it's true, like, we are afraid to touch hawthorn trees, the lone trees on hills.
Yeah. I've never pick them. I remember years ago bringing some into my house, picking flowers for my mum, and she was like, no, no. And that's, you know, she started talking about the fairies.
In the DeLorean factory, apparently, the guy he cut down a hawthorn tree because his builders refused to do it, and that's why apparently went
naturally
under.
Naturally, the whole thing.
You see, that's the thing. Well, planning applications have been diverted because of hawthorn trees. You know, loads of
proper
have been denied. Yeah, proper order.
When the fairies were good legislators in the day, and we could do with them now.
From Thursday's Oliver Callan Show. On Wednesday's News at 1, Regina Fitzpatrick, heritage officer with Kilkenny County Council, spoke to Rachel about Petronella de Meath, the first woman in Ireland who it's believed was burnt at the stake for witchcraft 700 years ago.
We know that she was from Meath. We know that she lived in Kilkenny in the early 14th century in 1324. We know she had an association with Alice Kittler, who was a very famous merchant woman in the town at the time. And primarily what we know about her is that she was burned alive at the stake in Kilkenny on the 3rd of November 1324, accused of witchcraft.
And is it known why she was accused of witchcraft?
So I suppose the main character in the Kilkenny witch trials was a businesswoman called Alice Kittler. She was very powerful. She was from a Flemish family of merchants. She was so wealthy that even King Edward II was one of her debtors. She had lost three husbands, and the stepchildren of one of the husbands basically accused her of witchcraft and having sort of poisoned and killed them. And this came to the attention of the then Bishop of Ossory, Bishop Richard Ledred. And Bishop Richard Ledred had basically a fear of sorcery and witchcraft. And Alice Kittler and her associates became the targets of that. And an inquisition began into the carries on, I suppose, of Alice Kittler and Petronella and 10 others by association.
But most of them, I think, escaped, and it was Petronella who was executed.
Absolutely. So Alice Kittler herself was very, very well connected. A kinsman of hers was Roger Outlaw, who was the Chancellor of Ireland, the seneschal or chief official of Kilkenny. Another relative of hers was Arnold de Puer. And they fiercely defended her, along with, you know, a lot of people in Kilkenny and a lot of the authorities in Kilkenny and Dublin. She managed to flee, having been arrested. Her son managed to not be executed. He was able to pay off his debt, which ended up being the equivalent to over €1 million at the time for the charge. We know very little about anybody else. Petronella's daughter, Sarah, was also charged, and one account suggests that she fled with Alice. And then we know Petronella was burned at the stake. We know nothing really of the others. We have very scant accounts of the time, and really the primary source for what happened was the account written by Bishop Richard Ledred himself, which is, of course, quite subjective.
Internationally, how important is this story? Because, of course, all of this was happening a very, very long time ago.
It's very significant in that just before, I suppose, this incident, the Pope at the time, Pope John XXII, who was quite paranoid about sorcery, had kind of promoted witchcraft to the crime of heresy before it was more of a petty crime. And so the template and the Inquisition, the inquisitorial, I suppose, process that was developed by Richard Ledred in Kilkenny becomes the template for subsequent witch trials right across Europe. And there was a spate of witch hunts across Europe over the course of the Middle Ages. And during those witch hunts, over 50,000 people were killed, charged with witchcraft. And the template used to charge them was the template creation of Kilkenny. And we know that about 80% of those that were killed were women. It was disproportionately a crime that was pitched against women. And then we know that subsequently this crosses over the Atlantic to places like Salem as well.
Regina Fitzpatrick is heard on this week's News at One. Liveline was also in spooky form on Thursday with lots of stories about ghosts and ghouls to mark Halloween. Daniel Curley, a local historian from Roscommon, called in to tell Joe about an entrance to the portals of the other world just outside the village of Tulsk, which is part of the archaeological landscape of Rathcrohan.
The cave at Onagat, as we call it, is regarded in our early Irish literature. Some of these stories are written down 1,200, 1,400 years ago. Has been a portal to the Irish other world. So we talk about it in academic terms of the other world, but mm-hmm. like what you're saying with the previous callers, the she, the fairy world, in a sense, yeah. A parallel dimension that we would have conceived of in our ancestors, and probably partly responsible as to how the world changes. It's responsible for, I suppose, different things that occur that we have no explanation for. So this particular time of the year is very prominent from that perspective, because we're marking the point of transition from autumn into winter. And that would have been marked traditionally by the festival of Samhain, we know today, obviously, as Iha Hauna or Halloween. So on that last night between autumn and winter, it's said that a whole litany of creatures and manifestations emerged out of the other world through the cave at Uv Crokin or Oan na Gach to create the world ready for winter. So they talk about flocks of red birds whose breath is so foul it takes the leaves off the trees. They talk about giant wild boars and every piece of vegetation that they touch withers. Mm-hmm. For up to 7 years, they talk about female werewolves, I don't know why they're female, three-headed monsters, giant cats, otherworldly armies, all of which come out on the last night to create the world ready for winter. And it's all curated into place by a goddess of war that resides, a famous goddess of war you see her today, perched on the shoulder of Cú Chulainn in the window in the GPO in the General Post Office on O'Connell Street as the Raven. So she's known as the Morrigan, and she's the one that resides in the cave, and she comes out of the cave on Samhain night basically to manage all this chthonic energy that's going on out there as the world transitions from autumn to winter, and then brings them back down and closes the door at the end of the night.
And that is tonight?
In essence, I mean, that's what we mark today in modern Halloween, and the bones of the origins of Halloween is based in our early Irish literature, and obviously with places like Oan na Gach, the Drachtgrán.
Is that an actual cave?
It is, yeah. So it's partly man-made and it's partly natural. So there's a natural cavern. So this is limestone country, Roscommon is limestone country. So it's basically one of the natural fissures that occurs in the limestone. And millennia ago, our ancestors decided to attach an entrance to it and very deliberately curate and kind of create a passageway, a formal passageway down into this cave. And it's even marked with Om inscriptions. So Om writing being the earliest form of writing known to the Irish. So it refers to two very famous figures of early mythology. We have our Queen Maeve mentioned on one of the Om stones, and we also have a great Connacht warrior called Freoc, who's central part of the whole narrative out here.
Roscommon local historian Daniel Curley, a caller to Thursday's Liveline. The neighbouring county of Leitrim featured in the final episode of Vincent Wood's County Measure, which was broadcast on Bank Holiday Monday. In this excerpt, Vincent meets up with brothers Frank and Pat Fox, who for many years have taught Irish dancing around the county and beyond. Vincent met them on the border of Leitrim and Fermanagh, where they remembered what life was like in that part of the world during the 70s and 80s.
Pat, there was another night that you ran into a UDR patrol when you were crossing.
In Ahawani, outside of Kilte.
And it had the highest van.
They had the whole road blocked with broken glass. I knew they were there, but I thought I stopped. But I thought, okay, I can't start to go back. Now, if I go back, they'll shoot me. I'll be acting suspiciously. So I just drove across the glass, you know. About 30 of them came out and jumped and asked me to get out of the van, and there was two or three of them in one door and another one in my door. And I was standing at the door, and I remember as well, there was this fella. I'd say he was only about 18. But I remember, you know, there were M16. There were the big guns. And he kept it to my ear the whole time. And I don't know, do you remember the old American ex-army coats? What's this here? What's this, he says. So I said, that's an old coat I use for work, you know. And he says, there's three of them in there. What do you need three for, you know?
I do the work at three.
I didn't know. I said, there'd be a few fellas. Because everybody that was working on buildings that time, they all had these coats because they'd be heavy.
Yeah.
Eventually, they said, you go on there back there and don't effing and come back. Get you effing back. So I had to reverse the whole way across.
But then, of course, the UDR, a totally different kettle of fish.
Well, that was the difference. Like, you know, more than likely, if you were to have a bad experience, it was with the UDR. Yeah. Well,
it was always tricky when you were stopped, especially by the UDR. If they ask you what was your mission, you know, you didn't like to say that you were promoting Irish music and dancing, or, you know, so you had to be very cautious with how you worded it, you know.
I think we'll dance the harm of all those years away and all those memories. Got to get you to dance on the bridge, on the border, and we have a great musician here with us, Michelle Mulvihill, piano accordion. What better way to mark the future and sweep part of that past out?
Absolutely.
Lovely.
Absolutely.
Some dancing on the radio there from the final episode of The County Measure. And of course, if you want to listen back to any of those 32 episodes, they're all available now on the RTE player. When the news came through on Thursday that former RTE broadcaster David Davenpower had died at the age of 72, tributes were paid to him from all quarters as people remembered him as an accomplished journalist and much-loved colleague. On Friday's Morning Ireland, David McCullough and Bertie Ahern shared some of their memories of DDP with Áine Lawler.
He had a brilliant turn of phrase. He was incredibly witty. He had a great fondness during his lives on the 6 or the 9 o'clock news for saying, oh, the wags in Leinster House are saying X about whatever was going on at the time. And 9 times out of 10, and probably more, the wag in question was one D. Davenpower, because he was able to come up with the funny line that summed up a crisis. And of course, that was on air where he was. I suppose deadpan, professional and all the rest of it. Off air, he was just hilarious. He was a fantastic raconteur.
You first met him in the evening press before you went on to work with him.
Yes, he had a brief but glorious career in Burkey. He had left RTE to become head of news in Century Radio, which ended in tears for all concerned. And again, he had hilarious stories about that. But anyway, that had ended in tears, and he applied and got the job as political reporter of the evening press, very deservedly. And he was with us, I think, for 3 weeks, 2 of which he took as holidays. And then he handed in his notice because he had got the job as Northern Editor of RTE. And obviously he was going to take that, much to the loudly expressed annoyance of the newspaper's editor at the time. But he was then forever after known in Burkey as David Gone in an Hour.
Another story David recalled was a memorable report David Davenpower did at the Fianna Fáil Ardéis in 2008 under challenging and slightly comic circumstances.
People look at that and they think he was standing on the floor and was surrounded by people. He wasn't. He was on a riser, a small stage, himself and the camera person. And all these party colleagues of Bertie's there got up on chairs so that they could be behind him. And they surrounded him. And one of them actually fell off the chair at one stage and then climbed back on again. And it was the most incredible thing. And as Bertie says rightly, DDP just kept going. Now, that thing after the leader speech at the Ardéis is pretty nerve-wracking. He used to call it the wall of death, because you were relying on other people to cut the right clips and play them in the right order. So it was nerve-wracking enough as it was without these lads, this chorus. But he loved the clip, because the clip went on YouTube. I don't think we referred to things going viral in those days, but he kept showing me. He said, look, how many views it has now. He loved it. He was really proud of that.
And he also loved, didn't he, the letter of complaint about the so-called wig.
Yeah, one of the great benefits of being on the telly is that complete strangers form strong opinions about aspects of your appearance and feel moved to tell you about them. So somebody sent DDP a letter saying, come on off it, own up, it's a wig, we all know it, just admit that you're bald. Which he wasn't, but he was so taken with this letter that he had it framed and put in the downstairs loo.
And for the last word on David Davenpower, Áine and Bertie both shared personal memories of their dealings with him on the week the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998.
I remember him giving out hell about being out in that castle building. It was bad enough inside, but he was out in that car park for a week, and it was cold weather, and he didn't appreciate it one bit. And whenever we went out to him, he left us know it as well. But no, he was a wonderful.
And do you know what, Bertie? Bird. Just on that, because yeah, it was freezing out in that car park, and that night, and the loos were overflowing. The coffee had run out. It was dreadful. And David knew we would be going on air with Morning Ireland. So during that night, I think about 3 o'clock in the morning, he took me aside. He put me in his car. He turned the heater on, and he got me to warm up. It's just, and you didn't argue because it was David Davenpower, and that was just the mark of the man, but it was very cold.
From Friday's Morning Ireland, Emma Hetherington is a best-selling author, and she's just published a new book called Maybe Next Christmas. She was Claire Byrne's guest on Tuesday, but instead of being able to come into studio, Emma had to do the interview from her hospital bed.
Well, I'm speaking to you today from my hospital bed in Belfast City Hospital, where I'm being treated for blood cancer. I was diagnosed back in March, beginning of March, and I've had 6 months of chemo, and then this is the last huge hurdle. I'm having a stem cell transplant today. So when we're finished talking, it's all systems go here, and I will be getting my stem cells back, hopefully to give me some sort of remission from this very challenging, incurable disease.
So that's happening to you today?
Yes, at about 11 a.m. So very soon.
So tell us how you've been then. I've been looking at you over the weekend. You had your children in, and you had the ceremonial head shave, which they all helped you with.
Yes, that was totally unplanned. So one of the biggest dreads, I suppose, as superficial as it might seem to others, for me, was losing my hair. And I was afraid of how the children would react. And when I say children, we have four young adults and a 10-year-old. So maybe the 10-year-old, you know, I was really worried about how it might frighten him. So they came in to visit me on Saturday. Now, as of today, I'm not allowed any visitors for the next 6 weeks. I'm going to be in isolation. So they came in on Saturday, and I just suggested it off the cuff, and they all brightened up. They got the kit from the nurses here, and we made it into a really, really fun thing to do together, and took away all that fear, and they were delighted. They thought I suited it, and they went away a wee bit happier, I think, a wee bit more content, you know, and took away that fear.
So the next 6 weeks then, you won't be allowed to have any contact with your family. Will they be able to come in and wave at you through the glass?
No, the way that the ward is set up here, you know, I'm behind two double doors. I'm in a small side room. I've got everything I need, don't get me wrong, and views over Belfast City, which are spectacular. But I'm allowed one nominated visitor the whole time, and that person can't change. So the way I'm going to work it, I think, is just like if and when I need someone, I'll call on, you know, that'll be my partner, Jim. He'll be that nominated person. But I want him to focus on what's going on at home more so, and because I'm being very well looked after here.
What's the hope then when it comes to what the treatment you're having today, the stem cell treatment?
Yesterday I had a very toxic blast of extremely strong chemotherapy, which is going to kill everything that's left basically in its path. So the aim is now I'll get my stem cells back today. So I had them removed a couple of weeks ago, so I'll get them back today, and it'll take me about 6 weeks then to recover from those two procedures, because they bring on severe sickness, risks of sepsis, risks of intensive care. I have a long road ahead, but after that, the hope is that it's all worth it, and it will put me into some sort of lengthy remission before the cancer comes back, because it will come back. It's an incurable cancer, and it will come back, but hopefully this is my best chance of a few years.
The incredibly brave Emma Hetherington has heard on Today with Claire Byrne on Tuesday. This week's documentary on One Invisible Men, made by Alan Bradley, provided a fascinating insight into the world of incels, online forums populated by young men who identify as involuntarily celibate. There was a lot in there, including research, voiced-up montages of misogynistic online exchanges, and an interview with this young man who spoke openly about how he got sucked into the whole incel mindset.
It can feel very isolating. Sometimes you feel maybe subhuman, that you're not even fully a human being like everyone else.
Paul was into gaming and was already on chat forums. On the internet, he came across what seemed like an explanation to his situation.
My first introduction to the thinking probably happened in my mid-20s. The only board I ever really looked at was V for video games. The common insult that people would have thrown each other on that board is that you live in your mum's basement and that you're a virgin, therefore you're kind of less than human. I would have got a lot of exposure to a lot of that discourse, even though it wasn't what I was going to the website for. Scrolling through threads, maybe I'm opening up a thread, just something funny. You'll see somewhere a reference to, you know, someone being an ugly virgin.
He stumbled across incel forums online.
You go to an incel forum and you say, yeah, this is a photo of me. I look really, feel really ugly. And people say, yeah, you are really ugly. You know what I mean? Like, that's what they tell you back. There's no one to tell you, actually, no, you're a good lad. You know what I mean? And you've got a lot of good qualities.
But at the time, this resonated with Paul. And in a strange way, was sort of a comfort to him.
You know, this is the reason why you failed. You failed because you're a 4 out of 10, right? No one's attracted to you. And you go, yeah, actually, that makes sense. I wanted a simple explanation that maybe made things not my fault, and that's why that was appealing. How many young men, even if they do have a good friend group of other young men, how many are going to open up and admit, yeah, lads, I feel really shit about being a virgin. Sorry, pardon my French. You know, you're not going to say that out loud. Everyone wants to exaggerate what they're doing in the bedroom. They don't want to admit that maybe nothing's happening. And that's hard, you know. And then you sit and you swallow it, and you swallow that feeling for so long, and it's in the pit of your stomach. And then eventually, you know, it's 2 a.m, you can't sleep, and you put a big rant out on Reddit, horrible misogynistic thoughts. You know, it's the same way if you repress any negative emotion and you keep trying to repress it and you keep trying to ignore it, you keep trying to swallow it, and it lashes out in a much more major way.
From last week's documentary on One Invisible Men, Ireland's Incels, made by Alan Bradley. Nick Harkaway is the son of the late David Cornwell, better known by the pen name John Le Carré, which he used to write his much-loved spy novels. Nick is also an author, and he's just turned his hand to writing a story featuring George Smiley, the central character in his dad's novels. In an interview with Oliver Callan on Thursday, Nick spoke about his relationship with his dad, who died in 2020, and what it meant to him to become an Irish citizen shortly before he died. In this excerpt, Nick talks about how, over the years, his dad liked to play around with his accent.
There's a transition moment where when he was in the 70s, particularly in the, well, 60s and 70s, when he was first famous, he had a very fake high Etonian voice, which he used for interviews. Yes, it sounded sort of, yes, when you write a novel, people ask you the question, did you make this up, or were you? And it was nonsense. It never belonged to him. And he actually says in the Pigeon Tunnel, the interview that the documentary film that they made, he says, I adopted the manners and voice of a class that was not my own. And I hadn't really heard it because I was too young. Yeah. And then I was listening to that on one of the kind of clips. I was like, good Lord, what was this? And if you can get hold of it, the audio book that he read of The Spy Came from the Cold in 1981,
yeah,
he starts out with the American handed Limas another cup of coffee, and then he goes into the American voice, and he can't do the crazy British voice, and he goes into his own for a couple of lines. And I was listening to that, I was like, that we should make a show just about that. Because this kind of adopted voice giving way to the real one, because it's who he really was.
I mean, the lovely story for us is that this once MI6 spy finishes off as an Irishman.
I cannot tell you how much it meant to him. When he died, I'd actually started, and I'm not even going to try, I'd started learning Irish, and we were going to learn it together.
Oh, really?
We wanted to do a journey together into Irish and Ireland. Mm-hmm. I got cracking on it. And then, you know, obviously when he died, I got a little bit, it fell away for me rather, because it was a bit painful because we never quite started off. I can't emphasize enough how much it meant to him.
You became fluent in Smiley instead.
I became fluent. Thank you very much. I'm going to use that. Yes, exactly. There's a silly picture. I gave him an Irish flag on his birthday because he just got the notification through that he'd been registered. We were all a bit plastered, inevitably. So there's a photograph, and it's of course upside down. I think he then put it on his chair in his workroom upside down too. So we've got this kind of glorious but terribly embarrassing picture.
From Thursday's Oliver Callan Show. On Bank Holiday Monday, Arena broadcast a live interview which Kay Sheehy did with the actor Brian Cox. In a wide-ranging interview, he spilled the beans on working on Succession and his thoughts about lots of his contemporary actors. In this clip, he talks about working on Spike Lee's 25th Hour with Edward Norton.
What was so exciting about it was Spike Lee. I mean, Spike Lee is, I think, it would be unkind to say he's the best, but he's certainly one of the top directors and one of the most admired directors. I loved Spike Lee because he puts you in exactly the right position. So you feel immediately at home and you feel that you can do your work. Just a great, great imagination. I remember with Edward Norton, because Edward fancied himself as a, can I borrow your pages?
Of course.
He fancied himself as a writer, you know, and so he's, I'll borrow your pen as well. So Edward comes up to Spike and he goes, "Now, Spike, I've been looking at the script and I just think there are a couple of things that we could lose. I think we could lose this, and I think that doesn't quite work, and this, and I think it'd be better if I said this, because I think this is really, really more to the point than that, which I don't think is to the point at all. So, and Spike went, and he took this cup and he went, yeah, yeah, this is good. This is very good. Anyway, so what we're going to do is...
From Monday's arena. That's about my lot for this week. America's Got Talent contestant Stephanie Rainey was a guest on the Ray Darcy Show on Tuesday. To play us out, I picked a rendition of a song she performed, made famous by Bruce Springsteen. This is Dancing in the Dark. I'll be back again next week. So until then, goodbye.
I get up in the evening.